Small is the gate and narrow the path that leads to life. Hello, Philadelphia. You're tuned in to The Narrow Path with teacher and scholar Steve Gregg on Heritage News Talk, WWDB. Over 2,000 years ago, a Jewish carpenter stood up against the powers that be and said and did things that changed the course of human history. Today, Steve will open up the phone lines to address what you would like to know about what was said and did in the Bible. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you about what it takes to find the narrow path that leads to life. When the radio show is over, we encourage you to go to thenarrowpath.com, where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We take your phone calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith that you'd like to ask and we can discuss together here. You can call if you have a different viewpoint from that of the host and want to discuss that as well. Be glad to talk to you. The number is 844-484-5737. We have lines open right now if you want to call. The number is 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Alan from Arlington, Washington. Alan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, how's it going, Steve?
Good.
So I had a question about like a specific translation of, I think it's Romans chapter 5, verse 7.
Okay.
And it just says basically somebody would rarely die for a righteous person, and yet some might die for a good person. That's about 80% of the translations of, like, standard Bibles that we have now, but I believe the NLT says it just translates it differently, and I was just wondering if I can get your explanation on that, and then I had another question about the NLT after that question.
Okay, well, yeah, Paul basically is talking about how remarkable it is that Christ died for us when we were not good people, when we were sinners, and we were even his enemies, as he says in verse 10. In verse 8, he says we were enemies. Verse 8, it says we were sinners. Verse 10, it says we were enemies. Now, most people won't die for their enemies. In fact, most people won't even die for a good person, and that's what Paul is saying there in verse 7. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. So he's basically saying there aren't many, though a few, who would die for a righteous or a good person. The words righteous and good are simply used as synonyms. He's basically saying that Jesus died for us although we weren't good, but very few people would die even for a good person, though you might find a few who would, is what he's saying.
Yeah, my bad. I guess specifically, the translation that I get, that I've seen most of is the one you quoted, where it's like, some might die for a righteous person, or
good person.
It'd be unlikely for a righteous person, but some might die for a good person. And just my perception, I always just assumed righteous was kind of a better version than a good person. And the NLT seems to botch that altogether.
Hello? It sounds like his phone gave out on him. Yeah, I'm not really sure where you're finding a problem here, but I know that some people, and maybe this is the problem you're having, some people think that Paul is making a difference between a righteous man and a good man, saying, well, people won't generally die for a righteous man, but some will die for a good man, as if a good man is something different than a righteous man. Paul's just using two different ways of talking about a person who's not a bad man. Jesus died for people who were bad. But the opposite of a bad person is a righteous person or a good person. And he's saying, it's very, you know, it's very unusual. Very rarely will a person die for even a good person. But the point he's making is that it would be far, far more remarkable for someone to die for someone that they don't regard to be a good person. But I, as I understand it, righteous man and good man are essentially synonyms. He's talking about the same kind of person in both cases. There are good people, righteous people, and most of us would be very squeamish about dying for somebody else, even a good person or a righteous person, though there are some who do so, some who would do so. For example, of course, most people, we would hope, would die for somebody they love, like their child or their spouse, hopefully. At least they should be prepared to. Of course, we should be willing to die for people if they're, even if we don't have a personal relationship with them. But the truth is, this isn't really a very problematic verse. Now, I'm not sure what the New Living Translation says, which you said you found it to speak differently about it. But you're not on the phone anymore, so I don't know, and I don't know why you're not. But your phone may have given out. Sounds like it did. So I'm not seeing what your problem is with this, but I'm wondering if perhaps you're trying to make a distinction between the righteous man and the good man. And that's not what Paul's doing. He's not making a distinction between a righteous man and a good man. Both of them are the same man that he's talking about. And he said, not many will die for him, but a few would die for a good person. Anyway, if I'm not getting your point, feel free to call back. You can get through again if you want to. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. You know, Gene wrote and said, Steve, could you please explain where in the Bible is a meaning of sin? I would imagine many would verbalize the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount. I need a better understanding. Thanks. Well, sin is a term used fairly broadly in the Bible. It says in 1 John chapter 2 that sin is lawlessness. That is, sin is living as if you're not under anyone's law, God's law in particular. We are under God's rule, and if you act rebelliously against his rule and you live as if his laws don't matter to you, you'll be breaking his laws, and therefore you'll be sinning. Sinning would be a violation of his laws. And, of course, he's talking about individual acts of sin are individual transgressions against God's laws. But sin, the word in the Greek simply means missing the mark. So it may even be so, not so much that you're a deliberate rebel in your sinning, but you're just failing to live up to the standard. God has set a standard of obedience and righteousness, and you may not be intending to be a rebel, but you're not living up to his standard. You're missing the mark. Missing the mark means you're aiming at a target, but you're not hitting it. And therefore, sin is falling short of what one should be. Paul says in Romans chapter 3, verse 23, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. I think sinning and coming short of the glory of God are being used as interchangeable ideas here, that we should be living for the glory of God. Our whole lives, in all ways, should glorify God. Paul said, whatever you do in word or in deed, do all to the glory of God. The whole purpose of living for human beings is to glorify God. And when we fall short of doing that, that's sin. Now, Paul spoke about sin not only in terms of individual acts of sin, but also as something dwelling in me, in my members. If you read Romans chapter 7 and the latter part of that chapter, he talks about, I desire to do well, but there's something else in me, sin dwelling in me, that kind of brings me into bondage to behaving badly. So he seems to indicate there's something in our nature called sin. Now, this is a little different than a reference to individual acts of sin or sins. Our sins are our unlawful actions. Sin is that which is in us that generates sins in us. There's something in our nature that tends toward self-centeredness. And self-centeredness, when it is given its head and given vent, is, generally speaking, doing things that are at the expense of others or at the expense of the glory of God. And putting oneself first means they're not putting God first. So this is something that's in our nature, that we tend to put ourselves first. And that's what Paul refers to as sin in my members, sin in me. It's a quality in me. It's a force in me. It's a law in my nature, Paul says. Now, so we have this sin in our members, which is like a disease that inheres in us, in our human nature. But we also have sins, plural. And sinning is when we are violating God's standards and thus falling short of what we are supposed to be. It's missing the mark. We're aiming. Sometimes we're not even aiming. Sometimes we miss the mark because we're not even aiming at the mark. But even when you do aim, when you do want to glorify God in all things, you still fall short because of weakness. And that's what sin is. Sin is when we're falling short of glorifying God as we should. All right, we're going to talk next to David from Newport Beach, California. David, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I got a quick question for you in regards to the differentials between the Masoretic and the Greek Septuagint text. I saw recently a video posted by some kid on YouTube, a college kid, and I thought he had a really interesting point. In the Septuagint text, he was going through the book of Genesis family lineages, and he was noticing the differentials between the Greek Septuagint showing the ages being older from father to son just after the flood between the generations, and that it was different ages that were much younger when they had their kids in the Masoretic version. And I wanted to get your take on that, if one was more correct than the other, or why that might be.
Well, the differences there I have heard about. I've never really looked at the numbers, but I have heard that the ages in the genealogies in Genesis 5 are somewhat different in the Septuagint than in the Masoretic text. Now, for those who don't know what you're talking about, the Masoretic text is the Hebrew text of the Bible, which was used to translate most of our English versions. And the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew text, a translation that was made by Jews in Alexandria, Egypt, almost 300 years before Christ, about 285 B.C. Now, what that means is our Masoretic text, which is the Hebrew text available to us, it really doesn't go, it's not that ancient as far as the copies of it we have. There were, of course, more ancient copies, but we don't have them. The copies we have date from around 1000 A.D. for the Masoretic text. Now, we're talking about the Old Testament. So we're talking about a text of the Old Testament that's no older than about 1000 A.D. So there's a big gap between the time the Old Testament was really written and the time that these particular manuscripts available to us came into existence. Now, the manuscripts, of course, are copies of earlier manuscripts that we no longer have. And those themselves were copies of earlier ones, and those were copies of earlier ones. So the text was copied for over 1,000 years between the time the Old Testament was written and the time the Masoretic text documents that have survived came into existence. But they do represent an earlier text, obviously. They are copied from earlier Hebrew texts that are no longer around. Now, some people think that since the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, not in Greek, that the Masoretic text is going to be a better text than the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation. But we don't know if that's true, because the Hebrew text as we have it is, of course, not a very ancient one. And the Septuagint is a translation made from a more ancient set of manuscripts in Hebrew, manuscripts that no longer are available to us. 285 years before Christ, when the 70 scholars in Alexandria, Egypt, started translating the Hebrew into Greek, they had Hebrew text that was hundreds of years older than the text available to us now. And it's possible that the translation they made was a good translation of a superior Hebrew text, superior to the Masoretic text. So there are people who think that the Greek Septuagint actually preserves the original meanings and numbers and so forth in the Old Testament better than our Masoretic text does, though all of our English Bibles use the Masoretic text to translate the Old Testament. Now, one thing's interesting is that Jesus often quoted the Septuagint, and did, as did the apostles. And some of the New Testament writers use the Septuagint exclusively. The book of Hebrews, for example, never quotes the scripture except from the Septuagint, which means that the New Testament writers believed that the Septuagint was a good translation. Now, did they recognize it as a perfect translation? If so, then the Hebrew Bible, as they knew it, must have been closer to the Septuagint than our present Hebrew Bible is, and that's something that is debated. I can't resolve that. It's much more of a technical, scholarly debate, and even no matter how scholarly one is, I have a feeling you're going to find people on both sides of this who are equally educated. So I can't tell you which one preserves the original numbers of the ages of people and so forth. But you're right, there are differences like that between the Septuagint and the Hebrew text. Fortunately, the ages of those people, as interesting as they may be to someone who's trying to form a chronology, it's not very important from a practical standpoint. That is to say, if I don't know how old Lamech was when he gave birth to Noah or whatever, or how long he lived after that before he died, it's not going to change anything in my Christian life or doctrine. So there are issues in the textual criticism of the Bible that are left unanswered. There are questions that we may never know. Is the Septuagint closer to the original, or is the Masoretic text closer? Yeah.
He had one last point in his video, which I thought was compelling, but I don't know. I haven't had enough time to do any research on it.
Yeah.
But he had something to the effect of that there was a Jewish gentleman from Jews for Judaism that had made the claim that the reason why that lineage is important is to show that the Levitical priesthood still is derived from the Melchizedek priesthood, and the way that they justify that from a Jewish modern day Jewish perspective is through that lineage, because they ascribe Melchizedek as being Shem.
Right.
And so that was his reasoning behind it. I don't know if that's true or not, but I thought it was at least interesting to bring up.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it is interesting that the Jews, that is the tradition of the Jews, is that Melchizedek was Shem. And there are some interesting supports for that notion. We know that Melchizedek was a man revered by Abraham. Abraham looked up to him, although Abraham was God's chosen man. And, he was the man that all the promises were made to and through whom the Israelites came and so forth. So, who would Abraham have to look up to spiritually? Well, some people say Shem, because Shem was one of Noah's sons. And at this time, when Abraham met Melchizedek, Shem would still be alive. And Shem was Abraham's own ancestor and probably the oldest surviving man on the earth. Noah was long dead, and whether Japheth and Ham were dead, we don't know. But if Shem was still living, he would probably be, and he was, by the way, he was still living then. He probably was about the oldest man on the earth at the time, so he would be revered for his age and also for the fact that he was Abraham's ancestor, the oldest surviving ancestor. And this would be perhaps give reason for Abraham to look up to him as much as he did. Now, the main problem I have with the Jewish idea about that is, if he is Shem, why doesn't Genesis tell us so? Genesis is the one who is where we read that Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, became, the ancestors of all humanity. And Shem, throughout that story, is always called Shem. He's not called something else. Now, Melchizedek is called Melchizedek. Now, Melchizedek, of course, is a word that has a meaning. It means king of righteousness. And one could argue, well, Shem became the king of righteousness in Salem, Jerusalem. I'm sure that's how the traditional Jewish argument goes. The problem I have is, we aren't told that anywhere. I mean, it's interesting that Melchizedek appears without any lineage or anything like that. And we're not told that he's Shem. So if he was, it seems like that'd be very significant. And yet it's not mentioned that he's the same guy who came off the ark with his dad and his brothers. So I have my doubts.
If the Septuagint is right, then he wouldn't have even been alive during Abraham's time, too. So that's, I don't know. I thought that was interesting. I appreciate your time.
All right. Well, yeah, I can't argue for which set of records are the more accurate, the Hebrew or the Septuagint. And I got a feeling that among scholars you're going to find differences of opinion too.
Thank you so much.
All right, David. Thank you for your call. All right. The next call in line is Christian from Kings Valley, Oregon. Christian, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you so much. I want to, first of all, Steve, thank you for your teaching. It's so precious to me because I feel like you invite me to go back in time and walk the streets with Jesus, because it's so important to you to understand the original intent and the original meaning, the original story.
And now, Christian, I believe we've met. We met when I was in Monroe, right?
Oh,
or Philomath. In Philomath.
Well, we met about 3 weeks after I found your program, and
Right. Ever
since then, every day of my life, your voice has spoken into my earphones or my room.
It's great to hear your voice again. Good to hear your voice again.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I'm calling because there's this call happen, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of shaken. It was a while ago, and it was a really sad call because someone was calling because their friend had gotten someone pregnant, and he was trying to give advice to his friend, and in that story, you know, there was a girl who, you know, it was a preacher's daughter, and she was 15 years younger than this man, and they moved in together, which I have learned isn't okay. I never knew it wasn't okay. It seems okay to me. But I see through the teachings that you've given me that that's not okay, and that it's not, you know, that's the, I'm trying to understand why fornication is a sin, basically.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons. This thing can happen. They ended up getting pregnant, and this man wanted out. You know, he wanted to get away. He wasn't sure if it was his kid. His friend was trying to help him be a Christian and get out of the scenario because he thought that the girl was kind of crazy or something. Anyway, so my question for you is, like, I was understanding the reason why it's not okay to live in sin is that God created man and woman to come together and not be separated. So if you're going to, and the coming together, the union of the two is fornication, basically, but not really fornication. It's marriage, and then it's fornication. But the reason why fornication is sin is because it predates marriage, and that fornication is supposed to be preserved for after the commitment. You know, first you're supposed to make the commitment, then you can unify. And then you stay unified because God, Jesus said, you know, let no man separate people when
God
they come together.
Right.
Yeah, so I understood that. And then but it was hard, you know, you were giving advice, and I thought that it was important to marry her because he impregnated her.
I understand.
You know?
Yeah, well, I understand. Because what you're pointing out is that a person should not sleep with someone outside of marriage. And in the Old Testament, if somebody did sleep with somebody outside of marriage, if the girl was a virgin at the time, then the law did require the man to marry her, unless her father forbade it. That's how the law reads. You know, if a man sleeps with a woman and she's not married and not betrothed to anyone, then he has to marry her, the law said, but unless her father forbids it. So the father of the girl would have the opportunity to cancel that out, even under the law. And that would be because, although, you know, all other things being equal, probably the two should get married because they've been joined like that, the father's authority over his daughter and his ability to give her away in marriage or not is considered to be superior to the other obligation, because it actually even says, even if she does get married, even if she makes a vow, her father, if he has not known about it, can nullify it the day he hears about it. So the father could cancel it. Now, I don't remember the details of the story you're relating. And, I mean, it's been a while, I think.
Yeah, it has. It's been like over a month. And I'm sorry to be such a coward. I would have called sooner if I wasn't just afraid of talking about things that make me uncomfortable.
Oh,
but,
sure.
Yeah, well, that was a question that I had too, because so if I feel like I'm divorced, and I feel like one of the reasons why is not understanding male headship, or, you know, failing in being
failing
head
to be
of
a
my
leader.
Family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so if in this scenario, you know, I feel like the man in a relationship, like in a situation, has some headship, like this girl. I mean, both of them knew. They were both raised
right.
Christian.
Well, so Christian, let me just jump in here, because since I don't remember the details of the case, the man didn't want to marry the girl. Is that right?
Yeah.
Though
yeah,
he'd made her pregnant. And I don't know what advice I gave. In most cases, I would suggest that they do get married. But did her father have an opinion about this?
Well, it was really intense, because the way it was represented to you is the friend who called said that neither of these two are Christian.
Okay.
They were raised Christians, but now they're living in sin, so they can't be Christians, because if they were Christians, they wouldn't have done that. They'd been doing that for 3 months, so they were, like, consistently failing. And then so that kind of, in this friend's mind, nullified their Christianity. Also, they only went to church every once in a while instead of regularly. So he said, well, these are non-Christians, so how do I give advice to them? And then she had threatened that she would get an abortion.
If he didn't marry her. Okay.
And so that threw it off too, because, you know, abortion is a really intense subject.
And, Christian, I'm going to put you on hold here through our break. We're going to take a break for about 30 seconds, and I'll come back to your call because I have to sign off for some of our audience that are leaving us at this point. Some of the stations only carry the first half hour of the program. We do have another half hour coming up immediately for those stations that carry it, which is most of the stations. And so if you'll hang on, we'll talk to you again after the break. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website is full of free resources, though you can donate from there if you wish. The website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in 30 seconds if you're listening to a station carrying the whole program. We'll be right back.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. Welcome to our second half hour, our final half hour of the program. We were talking in the first half hour to Christian from Kings Valley, Oregon, and we got cut off by the bottom of the hour break. And so I held him over. And Christian, could you just state as briefly as possible what your question is about this?
Okay, so this would be about male headship, sort of, in terms of pressure, because there was a call a month and a half ago where a couple had been living together for 3 months, and then they got pregnant, and then the man wanted to leave. He wasn't sure if it was his kid. And the woman wanted him to marry her and threatened that if he didn't marry her, she would get an abortion. And the friend of the man was calling you to get advice about how to advise him and such. And so my question really was, at this point, first of all, I really pray, I have been praying almost every day that it's going well for them and for her and her family helped her.
Did they get did they get married or did they not get married?
You know, I don't know. The way he left it, it sounded like he was going to advise his friend that he shouldn't get married.
Okay. So then what is your question at this point?
You know, I was just thinking that what is the effect of, like, when you, I understand male headship in a family that's a married family and there's the man and that's male headship, but what is it in the world, like in a relationship before marriage, like would that man, in my opinion, that man kind of had a responsibility to marry her because he impregnated her, even though it was while he was doing it. I mean, they were kind of living outside of the rules of Christianity, right, shall we say. But, you know, does he have a headship responsibility that requires him?
He definitely has a responsibility to support the child if it's his. I mean, he had some doubts, as you repeated the story, he had some doubts as to whether it was his child. So when the child, I don't think he should marry her in advance of the birth of the child. I think that once she has the child, they could do a DNA test or whatever they do to make to determine patrimony. And if he is the father, then he certainly should support the child. Now, whether they should get married or not is going to be a question that I would have to leave, frankly, to them to decide, because they're not Christians. And I don't consider that as a Christian, my role is to disciple non-Christians. As you know, if people make a commitment to Christ, then it is the role of the church to teach them how to, you know, live as responsible Christians. But the church is not, the church is not given the role of civilizing or dominating the lives of people who are not Christians. And so, you know, the decision they would make would be the decision they're going to make without reference to God. And and that would be true whether they marry or don't marry. In general, you know, I would say if it's a good thing for the baby and all, that it'd be best for them to be married. Now, if there's some other reasons that make it like it's going to be a disastrous marriage and that it'd be ill-advised, I don't know that they're going to make things right by getting married, though he should be responsible for the child in any case. If they were Christians coming to me, I would have to weigh all the factors and counsel them along Christian lines. But since they weren't Christians, I feel like, you know, Paul said, who am I to judge those who are outside the church? You know, that's between them and God, not between us and them. So that's a very hard situation. I would say the woman, if she did not wish to get married pregnant and have a baby out of wedlock, she was certainly doing the wrong thing by living with a man and having sex with him. You know, I mean, she's certainly taking that risk. They are doing something when in having sex. They were doing something that only married people are supposed to do together. But they were in violation of that. But I don't know that that makes them married. I don't know that that makes them committed to each other. Now, obviously, making a baby together is something that in God's design is something for people to do only if they're committed to each other for life. But these people did the wrong thing. They weren't committed together for life, and they made a baby, and therefore they've sinned. Getting married, I don't think, will change the fact that they sinned. And therefore, whether they should marry or not would be something, if I were asked to give an opinion, which I was, but I don't like to give opinions to non-Christians about what to do, because they're not, I mean, what they need to do is get saved. What they need to do is become Christians and then follow Christ and so forth. But for non-Christians, if they ask my opinion and I was willing to give one, I would say I would look into the advisability of marriage in this situation on other grounds, not just the fact that there's a baby there putting pressure on you to do that, because marriage is for life. Raising babies is not for life. You know, when you raise a baby, that baby grows up and moves on, and the couple that made them live on together for another 40 or 50 years, it may be, or more. And therefore, the advisability of making a lifelong commitment to somebody, I think, should be based on something more than whether they had a baby or not. But, of course, the baby has got to be given every consideration. We might say, well, giving a baby every consideration should be they should have their birth mother and birth father living together. Well, you know, that would be ideal if they're going to be good birth mother and good birth father. If they're not, then I'm, you know, there are other situations that would enter into the council. This was a couple I do not know. It was a couple I don't have much knowledge of the backstory. And I think the question was, should he cave in to her threats that if he didn't marry her, she was going to abort the baby?
Right. That is the way the friend kind of presented it totally.
Yeah.
He's like, whoa, there's
See, I don't think anyone should get married out of blackmail. Now, if the woman killed the baby, that's on her, not on him.
Yeah.
You know, she could have the baby and give it up for adoption. She could have the baby and raise it. She could have the baby and continue to hope that the father will marry her. But killing the baby is something that she, in our society, she can decide to do herself. And unfortunately, I mean, the law will let her. And, so it's not really his responsibility, the abortion part. That's hers.
Well, I was wondering about that because, you know, first of all, if I was calling when I should have called, I would have recommended to him your lecture on refuse to be offended, because that's a beautiful lecture that kind of changed me a lot, because it's a great one about if someone throws something at you like, hey, I'm going to get an abortion if you don't marry me, you can just freak out and call that duress or whatever. Or you could just be like, oh, you're really scared that I'm not going to marry you. I love you. And let's work this out. And you know, if he'd heard that lecture, maybe he would have had that attitude. But
I can't really give any advice to this couple apart from what I was asked specifically, and that is if a man in that situation is threatened that if he doesn't marry her, she'll kill the baby. If a woman put a gun to her own head and said, "If you won't marry me, I'm going to blow my brains out." That's on her. You know, if she blows her brains out, no one who decides to live a moral and sane life is going to blow their brains out or kill their baby. But the man cannot be under duress made to do something as life changing as getting married under those circumstances. Now, I think that he should consider, if this is his baby, that he should look into every possibility of marrying this girl. I mean, assuming she's marriageable and things like that. But again, having a baby is not the only thing that justifies getting married.
Right. And it doesn't, you're saying, like, it is like separate than, like, fornication doesn't equal marriage. You haven't married
someone. No, fornication is sin. Marriage is not sin. Fornication is being involved in a sexual relationship outside of marriage. So fornication is what they already did. But see, again, we're talking about two people at that point in time that I was consulted, neither one of them had repented of their sin and turned their lives over to God. And therefore, my advice to them would be, you know, worth nothing. Because I would only give advice to people who are really wanting to live to please God, and those people, by definition, are going to be Christians. Listen, Christian, we've taken up a lot of time.
Okay.
I've got other calls waiting, but
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for your call. I'm sorry that remains still as vague as it is. All right. Michael from Live Oak is our next caller, and we're going to take that call, but we have lines open at this number as well, 844-484-5737. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, you can call, or you can call to disagree. I'm sure many people would give different counsel than I do, and you're always welcome to call and say why. The number, 844-484-5737. Okay, Michael, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Great to hear you, as always.
Thank you.
Before I get to my question, I just wanted to inform you that I've been going to the Calvary Chapel Sunday morning service as well.
Oh, you're stepping it up.
The men's Bible study took a break for July because of two facilitators had a lot going on, but it'll resume next week.
All right. Well, Michael, of course, all of our regular listeners know, but we may have people listening for the first time who don't know that you are a Buddhist, and you've been calling me for years and years and years, and you were been going to this Bible study at a Calvary Chapel in Aptos, California, for some time, and now you're saying you're going to Sunday morning service.
So, I love it. It brought me to tears last week. I mean, there's something so beautiful that comes through. I'm listening to.
And you've said that about many Christian gatherings you've gone to, and yet somehow you still want to resist, having what these people have. Why is that?
Well, all I know is my life has been less than stellar, lots of sin, lots of.
Well, so has everyone's. So has everyone's. That Jesus said he didn't come to call righteous men, but sinners.
The image that Jesus sacrificed his life, as we're told, for out of his agape love, his divine loving kindness for all the lost souls, and that I can feel the call to do that, and I can see all the things in me, all the resistance, all the momentum of sinful thinking that is antithetical to that. But it's just the profundity of what Jesus is about. It's really touching me. So I wanted to preface my question with that.
Sure. Well, I just would say, as you feel yourself, as you often do, drawn toward Christ, toward a commitment to Christ, just stop digging in your heels, man. Stop putting on the brakes and just go where you know I think God is calling you to go.
Well, I think you would have been very proud of me. I wish you could have been there. So every Friday, maybe it happens other days. I haven't seen it other than on Friday. But last Friday, it was originally one guy. Now he seems to have some comrades, and he's an old-fashioned. All three of them are like old-fashioned fire and brimstone street preachers right on Pacific Avenue.
Oh, yeah?
With a microphone and sitting up on a, or standing up on a sort of one of those milk carts.
Okay, and what did you do?
So this guy that I hadn't seen before, after he was done, I asked him if he was local. He said he went to some church, I forget the name of it. But and I said, well, what are their views? He said, well, we're a Calvinist church. And from the point of view, not just the Arminian, what is it called, the opposite of Calvinist?
Arminian, yeah, Arminian is the opposite.
From that point of view, but also from, say, Buddha never said that only some can come to nirvana. So mostly from your refutations of Calvinism, I respectfully challenge, I actually engaged in a debate as we were walking up Pacific Avenue.
You were a Buddhist debating a Calvinist for Arminianism.
That's right. Well, I always tell people I'm a Meshuggah, which in Yiddish means crazy.
I know.
Meshuggah, a Jewish Buddhist who loves Jesus. So anyway, I said, do you have children? And he did. And I said, well, you want the best for all of your children. You would not just son to have a good life, and he said yes, and I think I did pretty well. But then he got out the big guns, and I had no way of refuting my question. He brought up, I think it's Matthew 22:24, where Jesus actually mentions the elect, and I opened up my ESV Bible when I got home, and it does say that. So what does Jesus mean by the elect in that?
It's Matthew 24:22, where Jesus said, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Yeah, well, this is just one of the many verses in the Bible that talk about the elect. The word elect means chosen. And, of course, God has chosen to save all who will come to Christ. And so,
okay. All
so
right.
those who come to Christ are referred to as the chosen. Because God has chosen them to receive special eternal benefits because they have come to Christ. Now, the Calvinist, of course, believes that they are chosen before they become Christians. They were chosen to become Christians. That's the difference.
Before.
So the word elect, which means chosen. In fact, the same Greek word is translated as chosen or elect in different places in the Bible. But they would understand it to mean that some people were chosen to become Christians, and nobody else except those that God chose to become Christians can become Christians. But I understand it to mean that God has chosen those who are Christians. He's chosen to adopt them as
sure.
Well,
once somebody has made the commitment, yeah, then
yeah,
that's right. So they just interpret that for me. That,
yes.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, they sometimes talk as if the word elect and chosen are their own words and that they somehow are a Calvinist franchise. But the words elect and chosen are biblical words, even though, and they were in, those words were in the Bible for 400 years before Calvinism arose. That is to say, the New Testament was around for 400 years before there were Calvinists. Is Augustine who originated Calvinism, and that was 400 AD. So obviously Christianity has been very comfortable with the word elect and chosen before there were people to interpret it in a Calvinist way for centuries.
So he's now referred to as St. Augustine. Augustine, that was his theology? He came
yes.
up with that?
Yes, Calvinism began with St. Augustine.
All right.
And it developed in the context of a conflict between Augustine and another man named Pelagius. And they had an ongoing debate. And although Augustine, in his earlier life, taught against what we'd call Calvinist doctrines,
mm-hmm.
But in the context of his debate with Pelagius, he moved more into the direction that we would call Calvinist today. John Calvin, after whom Calvinism is named, got his theology from Augustine. And he would
mm-hmm.
say so.
Mm-hmm.
He was Augustinian, yeah. And Luther also. Luther was also, although he was before Calvin, he had many of the same views Calvin did, and he got them also from Augustine. Luther was an Augustinian monk.
And Augustine and the other theologian that you mentioned, how do you say it, with the P, Pelagian?
Pelagius, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were they German? Where were they from?
No, Pelagius was an English monk who I think had moved to Rome, if I'm not mistaken. And Augustine was part of the Latin or Roman church, but he lived in Carthage, or he lived in North Africa. And so he was actually, he had a monastery in North Africa and that he had founded.
But he was from someplace else, or?
Yeah, he was from a place called Hippo. Well, no, Hippo is, I think, where he ended up. I forget where he was born, but he lived a long time in Rome, but he wasn't born in Rome.
Where is Hippo? Is that in...
In North Africa.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah, he was a North African by a native, and he went to Rome as a pagan, and he was he fell in with he listened to a Christian leader named Ambrose, and it was I think it was Ambrose, and he was led to Christ by him, and then he went back to North Africa and was a leader of the church.
So in modern geography, would that be like Algeria or someplace else?
Maybe. I can't picture it on the map right now, but yeah.
All right.
It was part of the Roman Empire, so, and...
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, well, if I see this guy again, which may happen tomorrow, I'll be armed,
okay.
As it were.
Hey, all right, Michael, I need to take another call because I'm almost out of time.
Okay, Steve, thank you very much.
Good talking to you again. Thanks for calling. Let's talk to John from Seattle, Washington next. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I have a statement to Michael. Michael, there's hundreds and thousands of people rejoicing of your situation. I suggest read your Bible out loud 40 times to yourself. The question is, would God be totally justified if he decided to extend all the time numbers listed in the book of the Revelation of Jesus Christ? The Old Testament and the one book of Peter, the Lord regards our one day as 1,000 years and 1,000 years as one day. Does the language grammar prevent God from doing so? Any studies of this? For example, the millennium would be 360,000 God days in God's eyes, and the scorpion sting in chapter 9 of the book of Revelation of Jesus Christ would be 150,000 days. I'll take the answer on the radio.
All right. Well, I suppose God would be justified in doing just about anything he wanted to in that respect, but I don't think we would be justified in assuming that this is the right way to interpret it. You mentioned the Old Testament and Peter mentioning a day like a thousand years. Actually, what it says in Psalms 90 in verse 4 is a thousand years in your sight. He's talking, David is, or the psalmist is talking to God. A thousand years in your sight are as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. So he's saying a thousand years, which is a really long time for people, is a relatively short time for God. I mean, God doesn't, he's got no problem. He lasts forever. So what's a thousand years for us is many, many generations. But for God, it's just like yesterday, or even shorter than yesterday, just like a watch in the night, which would be 3 hours. The night was divided into four watches of 3 hours each. So that's what the Old Testament says on it. And then the New Testament, in 2 Peter 3, Peter says, a day to the Lord is like a thousand years, and a thousand years is like a day. He's not saying that where you find mention of a day in Scripture, you should understand that to mean a thousand years, or even that God thinks of a day as a thousand years. What Peter is saying is this. He says, in the last days, people will arise who are scoffers, and they'll say, where's the promise of his coming? For since the ancestors fell asleep, all things continue as they have from the beginning. In other words, many generations have come and gone. Our ancestors have come and gone, and yet nothing has changed. So how can you Christians say that Jesus is coming back? You thought he was coming back, but he didn't come back, and now there's another generation. And it's, in other words, there seems to be considerable delay. And Peter says, in answer to this, they don't realize that a day to the Lord is like a thousand years, and a thousand years like a day. What he means by that is that God's promise is true, regardless what the delay is. If the delay is one day or if it's a thousand years, it's all the same. That is to say, it doesn't matter how long the delay is. It doesn't impinge, or it doesn't impugn, I should say, the credibility of God's promise. God's promise is true, even if the delay is long or short. And that's what is meant by the statement in that context, that a day, it's like a thousand years like a day. It's, in other words, there's no difference whether it's a day or a thousand years to God. It's all the same because his promise is true regardless of how long he waits for it to be fulfilled. And, of course, Peter in that passage gives the reason why it has been longer than some people thought. He says it's not that God has been slack concerning his promise, but rather he's unwilling that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. So Peter says, well, the reason God's taking longer than one might wish is he's giving more opportunities to repent for people who, if he would have come today, they would not be prepared to meet him. But they might if he waits longer. And so he's waiting and waiting and waiting. He will not wait forever. He might wait 1,000 years. He might wait 10,000 years. But that doesn't raise any questions about whether he's going to come, any more than if he only waited a day. So I don't see those statements in Psalm 90 and verse 4 or in the third chapter of 2 Peter. I don't see them giving us some kind of a way of reinterpreting time in the Bible. It's just basically saying whether it's a day or 1,000 years, it's all the same to God. And I think that that's all it's really saying. It's not telling us that when you find mention of a day, for example, the scorpions, or the locusts with scorpion tails torment people for 150 days or 5 months, then that should be understood to be 150,000 years instead. That'd be very arbitrary to do that. Now, there are some interpreters, the Seventh-day Adventists among them, who think that the days in Revelation should be translated as years or should interpret as years. So the scorpion sting of the locust, which is 150 days, they say that's 150 years. But that's not taking a day to mean 1,000 years. That's taking a day to be a year. But that's not justified either in the text. That's just an arbitrary imposition of a standard of translating a day into a year, which is nowhere really justified in Scripture. It's what people do with the numbers in Revelation and the other symbols in Revelation often is very arbitrary, and I think to spend very much time being innovative about these things is to spend valuable time and emotional energy on something that those things could be spent better on elsewhere. there are things really calling for our attention in terms of how to live a holy life, how to impact the world for Christ, which we take time away from those things when we become obsessed with interpreting fine points of the book of Revelation. And that's why I don't necessarily encourage us to be overly concerned about those particular things. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are a listener-supported ministry. We pay for the time on many radio stations, and it's very expensive. It costs us tens of thousands of dollars a month to pay for the time on the radio stations. We have no commercial breaks, nothing for sale at our website or on the air. We have no underwriters. We just depend on God to provide through people like you who think the show should continue. If you think that, you may want to write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, The Narrow Path.